Next is in the matter of Richard Lettingham. Counsel could please step forward. Starting with the OAE, may we please have appearances?
Amanda Figlin, Deputy Ethics Counsel for the Office of Attorney Ethics.
Richard Lettingham, representing myself, pro se.
Ms. Figlin, please proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. This matter resulted from a District 3B hearing in February 2018, and the finding from that hearing is that respondent violated RPC 1.5A for charging excessive fees. The panel did not find any violation of RPC 8.4C, and the recommendation was 18-month suspension. The DRB found a violation of both RPC 1.5A and 8.4C, and in a split decision, the majority recommended disbarment, and the minority recommended one-year suspension consecutive to respondents' temporary suspension with a Proctor and CLE courses. The OAE recommends disbarment in this matter. Respondent represented an 88-year-old widow in her role as the executrix of her late husband's estate for a 10-month period between August 2011 and May of 2012. During that 10-month period, he billed his client 676 hours, charging her $118,300 for legal fees and costs of about $1,875. The client paid $88,199, which consisted of primarily legal fees and the costs of $1,875. Respondent has been temporarily suspended from practice since March 30th of 2015 due to a fee arbitration in the same matter. He was unable to comply with the recommendation of the fee arbitration panel. Respondent admitted in his brief before this court that some of his fees were unreasonable. He admitted that valuation of the stocks and the mutual fund assets in the estate, which was approximately 55 hours, was unreasonable. And he admitted that his work doing the probate issues for the state of Vermont, researching Vermont law and preparing a Vermont tax return, that he said that was unreasonable since he should have recommended that work out. And that work totaled approximately 120 hours, 52 hours in January and 77 hours in February. Respondent does not admit or explain why it took him approximately 265 hours to review the will, the two codicils, and to review financial statements, assets in the estate, and to take notes. Nor does respondent explain why he needed so much time to review tax law and to learn tax issues, and those months were March of 2012 and April of 2012. The OAE believes that this is a clear violation of 1.5A, clearly excessive fees based on the factors in that rule, particularly factor 1, 3, and 4. Respondent admitted that a portion of his fees were unreasonable, approximately 170 hours. He admits at this late stage of this disciplinary matter to his brief before this court that those fees were unreasonable. There was also expert testimony at the hearing finding that it should have taken an experienced estate and trusts attorney 30 hours for a total of $12,000 in billable fees plus another $3,500 at most for a Vermont attorney to handle the probate portion of that work. Moreover, common sense dictates that it doesn't take 265 hours to review estate documents and financial documents. We also believe that this is an 8.4C violation. The test was set forth in the Ort decision, saying when time records are so clearly disproportionate to the services described that an inference of deceit is justifiable. Here, hundreds of hours were spent to review estate documents and financial records, and that time spent is so clearly disproportionate to the services described that an inference of deceit exists here. The facts are not really disputed because the legal fees and the bills were before the panel and the DRB reviewed those. The fee agreement is in the record, as are letters that the respondent sent to the client. The question is primarily what sanctions should be imposed. The OAE relies on the Ort decision and the WOLK, W-O-L-K, and other precedent to recommend disbarment here. In the Ort matter, the respondent billed $32,000 for a $300,000 estate. In the WOLK matter, the attorney had created, in hindsight, a certification of fees and was claiming 3,000 hours were spent for a total of $162,500 in a personal injury matter. Respondent argues that those matters are distinguishable from the matter before this court. There are some differences. Obviously, the Orton matter did involve more egregious situation in the one representation because the attorney in that matter disregarded the client's instructions, took out a home equity line of credit on an asset of the estate, and then paid himself out of that home equity line of credit. The Walk matter also was different because there was a conflict of interest with a different client, so the facts are not exactly the same, but we believe this does rise to the level of the disbarment because of the substantial aggravating factors in this matter, in particular that there was the exact same misconduct, the excessive fees, and the 8.4C violation in the way that the respondent handled the 2007 matter, and that was the 2007 prior decision. Here there are no mitigating factors that were presented, and there are substantial aggravating factors. The first, of course, the prior disciplinary matter from 2007, where respondent billed over 202 hours and charged the client $51,000 in representing her to purchase a franchise. The respondent severely overshot the assignment, the decision from the DRB said, and did not advise the client what he was doing and what the anticipated billings were until the end of the matter. Then respondent threatened his client with criminal prosecution for her failure to pay his bills, and a 3-month suspension was imposed. That was a 1.5A violation, an 8.4C violation, and an RPC 3.4G for threatening his client with criminal action to collect the fee. Another aggravating factor in this matter is that the client was vulnerable, and we cited in Ray Torre. Here also, the aggravating factor is the lack of contrition, failure to accept responsibility, and failure of respondent to understand the harm that he's caused to the client. The respondent pays, as we said, lip service to remorse. He's apologized numerous times on the record, but he doesn't seem to believe, from what we see in the brief and what he has said in the various proceedings, that he really truly believes he did anything wrong. He continues to insist that he followed the right method. He argues that the expert at the hearing below, the expert witness, Mr. Jonathan Matte, and Mr. Kramer, the attorney who finalized the estate for Ms. Binder, he argues that they behaved wrongly, that Mr. Kramer filed a fraudulent tax return. He appears to be relitigating the fee arbitration matter. Respondent has also not paid anything back to respondent, though he's been suspended since 2005, even though he should be able to work as a CPA. His license has been suspended. Respondent says he values getting it right, and unfortunately, he appears to value getting it right at all costs, even to his client. So he's disregarding the instruction of Ort that he should be performing only the work reasonably necessary to further the objectives of the representation. And he does not appear to be recognizing how he's harming his clients.
How much does he owe? Now, the fee arbitration committee said that the reasonable fee was $15,000, and if I'm remembering correctly, ordered him to pay the difference between that and the $88,199.
I believe the order is $73,000 in that range.
Has any part of it been paid?
I don't believe so. Just in conclusion, the client here trusted him. Part of the deception is that she's relying on him. She is a vulnerable individual. He didn't explain what his strategy would be with the estate, and he failed to give her options, such as you can retain Vermont counsel or you can have someone else assist to value the estate. As found by the DRB, if he doesn't understand what he's doing wrong, he's likely to repeat the same errors. Mm-hmm. And that's all I have.
Did the estate owe any taxes after it was turned over to the successor attorney? Did the estate owe any taxes to the state of New Jersey under the estate and inheritance tax?
I believe, and respondent could explain this better, but I believe he filed disclaimers so that there would have been some amount owed, but because of the disclaimers, no amount of taxes were owed.
So it was zero?
Well, because of the work that he did. It's obviously a little complicated because he handled the estate first and performed substantial services. And again, all of that is not disputed. The hearing panel and the DRB stayed away from any suggestion that he didn't handle the estate properly because of the tax returns that he filed, so that's not contested. It's really, the focus has been more on the reviewing of documents, the reviewing of wills and codicils, the Vermont probate work. But those later months, again, the criticism the OA put in its brief is, why are you teaching yourself tax law if you're already a tax expert?
I thought, maybe I'm mistaken about this. I thought that the attorney who took it over and the expert on behalf of the plaintiff said that no taxes were owed but respondent had indicated that $30,000 was owed. And he was claiming that his former client had filed a fraudulent tax return. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, again, I'm not an expert on estates, obviously, but my understanding is that there was an estimated tax paid, and that was refunded.
Okay.
And there were disclaimers that were filed by respondent. Respondent's fully capable of explaining the tax issues and can handle that issue. The expert at the hearing did admit $23,000 would have been owed in estate taxes. So,
would have been owed. I'm sorry.
Owed by
the estate.
By the estate. Right. So, and again, the argument is that you're spending $120,000 to save $23,000. Maybe you should just let the $23,000 be paid, and your attorney bills you $15,000 total for the entire project.
Other questions, anyone? Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Bickley.
Thank you.
Mr. Lettingham? Let me say at the outset that we have the extensive materials and arguments that you've presented to us. Please understand this is not a factual hearing, and we're not here to take testimony from you. It would be most helpful if you could explain to us why you believe the OAE's conclusions and recommendations are off. You do have 30 minutes. You're free to use them as you see fit.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the New Jersey Supreme Court, my opening statement will be that I deeply regret putting Mrs. Binder through this estate after her husband passed away. Mrs. Binder and I and her husband had a very good professional relationship. But all the stress and all the worry that she has had to go through after her husband had passed away, it's really too much. And I readily admit that I mishandled this estate. I dotted the I's and crossed the T's, but I failed to look at the big picture. So just for the record, when the will was probated, Mrs. Binder forgot to bring her license. I made a copy of her license. I came back. I gave it to her, and I gave it to the probate. So we didn't have to go through the procedure all over again. I do have a copy of that license, and it is in the Exhibit D1A, where all the billing is in the back. She was 82 years old, as I testified, because that's what I testified to. Her date of birth was October 19th, 1928. So the numbers, I mean, I see 94 years old. She's not 88 years old. But now I'm talking about, and everyone was talking about, at the time that she hired me, she was 82 years old. That, you know, she's of advanced age. That really doesn't matter. Just wanted to clear the record. The qualities of a human being, trust is everything in life. Trust in marriage, trust in business partners, trust in representation to clients. It is everything. And I have built my life on that trust. So I do not take retainers from any clients. I've never taken one, because it's based on trust. Eventually they'll pay me, or they'll pay me what they want to pay me, but that's fine with me, because it's an honor and a privilege to practice law. Let me just say about the York case, and then I'll go into, and the Walt case. The qualities of those lawyers are not my qualities. They're not close. I've never stolen any money or property, as in the Ord case. He did not have permission to take the $20,000. And there are so many violations in that case where he worked against his client, didn't follow instructions of the client. And turning just briefly to the Walt case, attempted fraud on a federal district court. This case does not involve that matter. That was an attempt to justify his fees, which were fraudulent. There's only 24 hours in a day. He charged 33 or 34 and three-quarter hours in one day, 24 and three-quarter hours in another day. But investing in a property where he knew there's going to be a sheriff's sale, he has client invest in a property, that is concealment. That is doing something affirmatively against the client. And that aspect of it, when you group my hours in your brief and you say it's deceptive, 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 that work was done. And when you say it's deceptive, you mean, at least according to the dictionary, that it's deceit. So I don't agree with that. Okay, all the work was done. You can see all the work. I was extremely thankful for the first time, starting from the arbitration hearing, going through the due process problem with the first hearing with the Bergen County District Ethics Committee. There was a problem. It was remanded by the DRB. And I'm very thankful that this Burlington County District Ethics Committee looked at all of my documents. So, and the finding of that Burlington County District Ethics Committee was that they dismissed Rule 8.4C. Fraud is part of that, deceit, dishonesty, misrepresentation. Mr. Resnick told me, the chairman of that hearing, said, this is what we're going to do. We're going to look at all of your documents, and we're going to trace those documents to the billing. And we're going to, either you have the documents in the billing, you said you did the work, where is the work? And they found the work in documents, correspondence, calculations, research, the Vermont research, tax research, they found it. And that's why they said that there's no fraudulent billing. And they dismissed 8.4C. I understand fully. In life, there are differences of opinion. And some people believe one thing, others believe differently. But they found that. They essentially audited my billing. And I wanted them to do that, to prove that I did the work, because the charges from the grievances, since she filed two of them, but the last one is the work was unnecessary. Now, let me just break that down.
May I ask you a question?
Yes.
Your billing entries total 86 and three-quarter hours for the review of the will and the two codicils, and almost 180 hours for a review of the assets of the estate. I understand that you've told us you didn't exercised bad judgment and you've expressed regret for what you put your client through, but do you stand by those numbers as you stand before us today? Do you represent to us that they honestly and accurately reflect hours for those tasks that you worked?
Those were the hours that I put. I worked on it. I do not use, today you probably use an Apple phone because it has a stopwatch on it. But if I start work at 9 o'clock, and if I take a break at 12, I'm going to have 3 hours in there to come back to it. So those are the hours.
For the almost 87 hours for the review of the documents, the will and the codicils, how many pages?
43 pages.
And you, in fact, drafted previously the second codicil.
The second codicil.
So presumably, I'm sure you had reviewed the will and the first codicil previously, no?
Yes.
So were they relatively standard forms for the will and the two codicils?
The format, we have three tax lawyers doing these documents. It was not a format that I would use for my own clients. It was more complicated than that.
Well, why don't you tell us, what is it that took 87 hours, almost two full weeks, to review the 43 pages?
Well, I'm looking, those are my notes, and I have those, and they saw the notes. The District Ethics Committee saw the notes that I have, and I'm looking for, there's some changes, you accept some changes retroactive to the first, for the will, some changes to the first codicil, but then the rest of it flows through, because there are no changes to those particular sections.
Were you doing research as you were going?
Yes, I wanted to. I have, that's tax language. If you've looked at, anyone looked at my notes, I'm looking at tax language. And which trust is the Unified Credit Shelter Trust? That's share one. It was set up differently than other, than I would set it up, than I have set up things for clients in estate planning. It was a part two, that was a Q-tip trust. So some people were disinherited, other people came in, trusts were cut down, and I recommended that the trust for the two children of Dr. Binder, all these trusts are in full force and effect. So it's almost 18 years.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Let me tell you what I don't understand and see if you can explain it. I don't understand why it would have taken 86 and three-quarter hours to conduct a review of 43 pages. Please explain.
Okay. Because it was 43 pages, because it was not the format that I use, it was a different language, different format, and I'm looking because I knew ahead of time there was a tax issue, whether by having the trustees, the three of them, disclaim property that would normally go into the first trust, the Unified Credit Shelter Trust, where the trustees say, we don't want that property. You disclaim it. Then where is it going? You have to know where it is going. It is going to the second trust, which is a Q-tip trust, which could qualify as the marital deduction. So I'm making notes concerning who inherits, who has legal interest in all of these trusts, because I know I have to put it on the tax returns, Form 706 and the inheritance tax return. And I'm also looking to see, is it going to go to the second trust? Is it going to go to someone else? And I concluded that it will definitely go to the second trust, because you never want to do disclaimers where you disinherit people unknowingly.
What was the total value of this estate?
$1,354,227.
Okay,
$1,354,227.
Your total hours expended were 674, correct?
Whatever is there,
yeah.
I accept it.
That would account for an attorney who's putting in an entire year of work. That would typically constitute 4 months working on nothing else, every day for 4 months, working on this estate worth $1.3 million.
You are right. I made a mistake. I did not step back from the whole picture. That's one of my admissions. You are right. You're correct. And you have to realize that it's too much. And
did you pay your client back? You're admitting now that your client was overbilled. You went before a fee arb committee. We determined that the reasonable amount of fees was in the range of $15,000. Have you paid back the $73,000?
I have not paid back anything, and I will go into that, but I have not paid back anything.
Sir, do you have a copy of your timesheets in front of you?
No, I just have the briefs in front of me.
Right. Could you tell me what, in December 2011, you billed 55 hours. What was that for?
I'd have to look at it. That was probably valuation from my memory of the
stocks. Was there an entry, an entry in your timesheet what it was represented? Or was it just 55-hour bill?
No, the bill. Well, the bills are in D1A exhibit. My bills are pretty specific.
Well,
and I would have, every day I would have put in what I worked on, valuation of, and in December it probably was the valuation of the stocks, and there were probably 77 investments, 71 investments through Wells Fargo, plus another 6 investments in, they had a corporation, Camp Wyota, which had a long history being incorporated in 1948 in New Jersey, but it was for the camp where they conducted business, an adult music camp, that is, in the state of Vermont. So each day I would wake up or whatever and look and do the research, whatever I hadn't finished, on these securities. It happens to be required under Section 2031 of the code.
Right.
But I learned that because of my accounting background.
Let me before you talk, because all I have is an entry of 55 hours, no itemization or explanation. Then in January of 2012, you have 74 hours, no explanation. Many of them have explanations. March 2012, 110 hours, no explanation. April 2012, 87.75 hours, no explanation.
You're adding up the total. Those are the totals, not the daily. Those are not
the daily. Well, should the dailies or should the total show what they're for? The other totals show what it's for. For example, the August one, 86.75 hours, you explained that they were for review of last will and testament, first and second codicils for the purpose of taking notes, et cetera, et cetera. For September, you show their 83 hours review for financial documents, taking notes for the purpose of preparing all state inheritance tax returns. But yet for December, January, March, and April, even though they're totals, you show no explanation whatsoever on your
okay, whatever there is there, but every day has an explanation.
So
absolutely.
So for the December that Justice Fernandez-Vina asked you about, the 55 hours, I'm looking at the DRB opinion at page 6, and it says these were all to calculate the value of mutual fund and stock prices. Why didn't you just ask the brokerage company what was the value?
Well, I have asked the brokerage company, what was Merrill Lynch, and according to my testimony before the Burlington DEC, they really don't want to do that because that information is going on a legal document, and it's an important one, on signed under the penalties of perjury. You can get end of month statements, and you could take numbers from that.
Isn't that what's done generally?
Okay.
For interstates?
When you sign
a personal tax return and person dies?
You have to go according to the regulations under 2031. I just wanted to, Mrs. Binder, to just, I don't have to research that really. There was an issue about closed and open and mutual funds, but I just wanted to show her what I was doing because I know there's a reasonable diligence requirement.
Just tell me if I'm wrong about this. Don't estate lawyers take those statements for the appropriate time when someone dies and put them in as the value of the
holdings?
Holdings. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Late in the day. To file the tax return.
Yes, that's true.
And why would you possibly individually do evaluations as an expert, you know, as a non-expert on what those
because it's
are
required
worth.
Under the Internal Revenue Code 2031, and as I said before, the DRB, you have to take the high and the low for the day and divide by two because he didn't pass away on the weekend; he passed away on a Monday. But that was it. But you have to do that. Because when that's the basis of the stock, and when the stock is sold in the future by the estate, that's the basis to compute the gain. And that's been in the law as long as probably as if I've been alive.
How many mutual funds and how many individual stocks were there about?
There were only a couple mutual funds, but I have a note that there were 71 stocks held by Wells Fargo, and there were also, I believe, 6 stocks held by Camp Wyota inside the corporation.
So even if you did the individual calculation you just described, why not just go online, check the high or low for the day, and enter the number?
That's exactly what I did. If you look at the Form 706, also the inheritance tax return, they want a listing of each stock, which brokerage firm, which account, how it's held, the CUSIP number, the symbol number. You have to do that. And I am doing it quickly as I can. It's not a pleasant experience, but I'm doing it off the internet. And I'm doing it only one reason, because the law, the tax law, says I should do it.
So it's taking you an hour or close to an hour to figure out the
high and low?
They
said an hour per security. But
and dividing it by two for each?
No. I have to write it down, type it in. I'm preparing a schedule at the same time that's attached to the tax returns. Those schedules are attached to those Form 706 inheritance. I'm doing the schedule as I go along. So that would be wrong for me to charge an hour just to look the high and the low up on the stock. It's the schedules. So when you look at the schedules, you will see the work that is done.
The fee when did the fee arb committee make its determination?
October 15th, 2014.
So that's 5 years ago?
Yes.
Okay. And your client is now 91 years old?
90, I think.
90 years old?
Today.
And you have, in those 5 years, you've reimbursed none of the money that the fee arb committee said that you owed to her? Is that what you're telling us?
Yes, I have not reimbursed it. And
so now, here, give us your explanation. Okay. You said you wanted to explain that to us.
Yes,
go
thank
right
you
ahead.
Very much, Your Honor. That was in Bergen County, fee arbitration, and I went there. I brought all my records, which were five, including, you know, some of the books and everything, at least five trunks of records. It was a question and answer.
Arbitration. The question I asked you, just to be clear, is not to relitigate what the fee arb committee. I want you to explain why you haven't paid the amount that they said you owe her.
Because Mr. Mate, the tax expert for the committee in the DEC hearing, gave a fraudulent tax return to the panel.
Okay, so you're challenging this. Did you appeal the fee arb determination to the Superior Court?
The appeal is, it's number two, no, excuse me, it's number three of my brief. The fee arbitration is dated, decision is dated October 15th, 2014, and that's the number three document.
Okay.
Are you telling us that the court hasn't heard that yet 5 years later?
No, the court hasn't heard that 5 years later.
Have you filed it with the court?
I don't know those procedures, but...
Well, no, it's very simple. Did you file with the court, yes or no?
No.
Okay, so how do you think it's going to be heard if it's not before the court ever?
I don't know those procedures, but I...
No, if it's not before the court, sir, you're an attorney. If the court
right,
doesn't have the document before
right.
them to hear on it, rule on it, how do you think it's ever going to be heard? They don't even know it exists.
Okay.
So explain that to me.
Well, I filed that appeal, which is number three, which is part of my brief, and it was turned down as being late, and it was late. So...
How long after the October 2014 ruling did you file it?
Well, it was the day...
How late was it?
Well, it was the day before Thanksgiving, and therefore I had to put it at the post office. I bought postage, and it wasn't stamped. They had no stamp on it. That's right on the front.
So you filed it within 2 months? November 2014?
Yes. October 15th, it was filed November, the day before Thanksgiving in 2014.
So
yes,
so
within 2 months.
5 weeks?
Yes, I was late. It has to be 3 weeks. So it was, let's say, more than 5 weeks or around 5 weeks.
So nothing's been pending. You have no right to appeal. That was rejected as late.
That was rejected because it was late. It wasn't within 3 weeks.
So there's no nothing pending. You aren't challenging that. There's no court is considering that.
Did you appeal that rejection? Did you appeal the rejection? Yes
you
or
mean
no?
Did I appeal the decision?
Yes,
I did.
It was rejected.
I filed the appeal, but it was rejected.
And it was rejected.
It was
late.
And
you appealed that decision that it was late.
No, I did not appeal that decision. I didn't know that I could appeal that decision.
Did Mrs. Binder get a judgment?
Yes, she did. They got a judgment.
So you have a judgment against you. And what's the amount of that judgment?
It's $73,000 and something, which was the difference between...
Okay, so now you haven't paid anything. Just tell us why you haven't paid anything on this $73,000 judgment.
Because I couldn't pay it at the time, my license was suspended. And I took, the DRB said, why don't you try and get a job as a CPA? And I did. I applied to several CPA firms, including ones I used to work for, and I did not, probably because of my age, I'm 67, I want to hire young people, so I didn't even get an interview. I applied to universities, I applied to other places.
Are you telling us you didn't have the money?
I didn't have the money. Years ago, I would have had the money, and I would have drawn a check. But at this particular time in life, I did not have the money. So
did you make any effort to pay any of it?
Whatever I could not you could pay afford any every week? Because I'm living solely on Social Security. That's what the problem is. So if I didn't know I could appeal that to the Supreme Court, for example. I just thought once it was declined because it was late, that was the end of it, and I could do nothing with it. But my point, as in my brief, is that Mr. Mate, who was the tax expert for the committee, he was the tax expert at the arbitration hearing. The both DECs, Bergen County and Burlington County, rely on Mr. Mate. And I'm upset about that.
That train has passed. You have a $73,000 judgment.
Yes.
We're not here to relitigate that issue.
Well, I'm talking about that in regard to this hearing solely because of his credibility. And his credibility, he has lost it because he submitted what he should have known was a fraudulent tax return in the arbitration hearing where, according to my affidavit, which is number 2 in the brief, they said it was a $30,000 taxable estate. Now, the exemption in New Jersey has been for a long time. There's no more New Jersey estate tax, but it was $675,000 at the time. And to answer your question, there was $23,234 New Jersey estate taxes due and owing. They didn't believe me. Why? Because Mr. Mate gave them a fraudulent tax return where it just said the taxable estate was $30,000. That is not true. So in the testimony that Mr. Mate gave, I asked him at the Burlington County DEC, was tax due and owing from the estate? And he said yes. And that answers your question. So, and it was $23,254. Pardon me.
So you had full opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Mate at the hearing?
Yes.
Okay. And he testified, you testified, and the panel having the ability to assess the evidence as the credibility of the witnesses, to consider the consistency of the testimony, determined that Mr. Mate was actually telling making the correct statement and you were not. Isn't that what happened? And they had the opportunity to evaluate your testimony, your demeanor, your ability to answer questions, his. And they made a credibility finding based on what they saw and they observed. Correct?
I'm not certain that I fully agree with that statement, because what kind of credibility would the tax expert have who submitted a fraudulent return?
No, you're asking me to assess credibility. I'm saying that you had an opportunity to bring all that up at the hearing. The panel was there. They observed you. They observed him. They heard a testimony, and they made a credibility finding in his favor and against you.
And he said,
is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, isn't that the end of it? We're not here with Mr. Mate today.
That's what I'm going to credibility at the DEC hearing in Burlington County.
Are you ever going to have the ability to repay the $73,000?
I don't know whether I ever have a ability. I need a job.
All right. Are you applying for jobs now?
I applied for them. But this takes time, so I defended myself. This is my number one priority.
How long have you been applying for jobs?
I applied even before. I was still practicing law.
2015, 2014?
Applied to CPA firms.
And nothing? You've gotten nothing?
Gotten nothing.
And you're living on Social Security?
Yes.
So I think as we sit here today, are you saying, I don't really have a chance to repay this money?
I never want to say never.
I'm not saying never. I really, all right, almost never, for a long time.
That's certainly possible.
That you're never able to repay.
And you can see how upset I am, because it's evidence. So, but when he says 25 to 30 hours to complete this estate and $3,000 for the Vermont ancillary probate, he has no credibility. Because he just gave a fraudulent tax return to a tribunal.
Mr. Lenny,
it's a different hearing, yes.
What is the appropriate outcome in this case? What are you asking for as relief here? What should the discipline be?
I believe in all my heart that my qualities, trust is everything. So there's one question you would like to know. Can I be trusted to bill a client ever in the future? And I believe I can. I'll add to that this. After reading the book, The Honest Hour, Ethical Time-Based Billing for Attorneys, by William G. Ross, it's not worth, I know it's universally used, but the scrutiny, to me, it's best for me and for a lot of lawyers if you just select a flat price, because it's full disclosure. The client knows what they have to pay for, and you determine what your responsibilities are, and you must keep your promises.
So you have a 2007 prior disciplinary matter where you were suspended for charging excessive fees and threatening a criminal prosecution, and you've already told us, you've conceded in part, that there were some excessive fees in this case.
Yes.
Explain how we can have confidence that if you were allowed to practice again, this would not happen a third time.
Well, in regard to Ort and in regard to Wolk, look at the actions that they took. And do they have good character? No. But I believe, I'm defending myself, that I have good character. Can I correct this problem with hourly billing? Yes, I can, by billing a flat price. And it has to be a reasonable price. So that takes care of that. Putting that aside, could clients trust me? I believe they can. There's all aspects of trust. One of the things in this case, and it directly applies, is that my tax returns are the honest ones. I'd be happy to meet with any tax authority. But the tax return used in the arbitration hearing is fraudulent. It's not by a little bit. It's extremely material. And the why I brought it up is I was the one who filed the disclaimers. And the disclaimers deferred the New Jersey estate taxes of over $23,000. And Mrs. Binder survived. And in 2018, it's gone. So it was the right decision at the right time. However, I made two big mistakes. Those mistakes were I should have referred it out to Vermont Legal Counsel. Bill would be tremendously smaller, and I should have done it for free, the valuation of those investments, which is required. Now, there are different standards. The firm I worked for was PricewaterhouseCoopers. If you did a tax return and you estimated or you took the ending balances on a monthly investment bill, you know, it has all of the investments and the total amount. You can't do that because that's not the law. So they have standards and they have levels of supervision. You'd be fired because you weren't accurate, because the client is signing a tax return which is not correct. It's not true, it's not accurate, it's not complete, it's not according to IRC 2031. I was raised that way because I worked for Cooper's and Library since 1974, and now it's PricewaterhouseCoopers. If you don't do it according to the law, you're fired. But the sole practitioner can just put down numbers, estimates, and no one's going to fire him. And if he can get or she can get the tax authority to agree to it, you know, fine. But I'm raised. When I talk about raised, my professors in two different professions, CPA firms, law firms, you have to do the computations.
In light of all this, what is the relief that you're asking for now?
That I do not have the qualities of Ort or Wolk, and I should not be disbarred. I did not steal any money. I never taken any retainer, and I'm asking that you look at the entire 38 years of my license, not just the last 5 years. They haven't been good, but 38 years of my license, and I got as much education as I could get. I charged the lowest price. I've never charged $200, $300, $400 an hour. It's 175, and I should have lowered it even. I should have done a flat price for Mrs. Binder. We wouldn't be here if I had just done that. It's an easy solution. But however, the license is everything. So in order, it would help me to get another position. A lot of lawyers never practice law. So I need another position. So, but I do not have those bad qualities that those lawyers had, and I did not do those types of acts with Mrs. Binder. I never lied to Mrs. Binder. I never lied to the two DECs. I never lied to the DRB the two times I was there. I never lied at the arbitration hearing, and I'm not lying to you today. And I have nothing more to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yep. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's in recess.